Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Dr. David Katz. Dr. Katz is the founding director of Yale Prevention Research Center. He's a physician, prolific author, past ABC News contributor, past president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, and an expert on nutrition, wellness, and longevity. Dr. Katz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Derek, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to start by talking about an article that you wrote called Our Rage at Aging. In the article, you suggest a shift from resisting aging to embracing it. What inspired you to challenge this mindset?
You know, honestly, I don't remember exactly what got under my skin on a particular day and why I wrote this column exactly when I did. But I have been reflecting for quite some time that the whole concept of anti-aging is somewhat misguided, because aging is a biological process. It's a bit like anti-breathing. You know, if we just suddenly decided that it's inconvenient to have to take 20 breaths a minute, and you know, we should rage against that. Aging is a biological process. It's inevitable. It happens to everything. It affects different things, animate and inanimate objects differently, but even inanimate objects age. Rocks age. We could actually measure the age of the bones of the earth, if you will. The universe ages. Everything ages. And I think what particularly rankled me, and again, I can't recall exactly why that column that week. I'm guessing there was a provocation. I may reference it in the column, something that came out in one of the journals or newspapers I read. But I found, as I thought about anti-aging, that it sort of invites us to perennially compare ourselves to the younger version of ourselves. And so I think about myself in that context, and I'm turning 62. And I practice what I preach as a lifestyle medicine expert. I eat optimally. I work out every day. I'm extremely fit. But the simple fact is, at 62, I don't have the muscle mass, and I don't have quite the strength I had at 42 or 32 or 22. And things change over time, no matter the care we take of ourselves. So longevity is a laudable goal, a bounty of years in life. Vitality is perhaps an even more laudable goal, a bounty of life in years. And the combination is perhaps the best prize that health has to offer. A bounty of years in life and life in years, the combination of vitality and longevity. But that's not anti-aging. And so I was objecting to the way our culture packages this, because I think we fare better, certainly in terms of mental health, when we understand, appreciate, and align ourselves with prevailing forces around us, forces that we can't change. We can't undo gravity, we can't undo entropy, and we can't undo aging. It's a fundamental process. How do we ride those currents? And I think there's a greater problem, and that is if we buy into the value proposition of anti-aging, it sort of invites a morbid fear of our mortality, because the ultimate expression of aging is aging to the point where everything wears out and can no longer function. Death. Death is the ultimate end of aging for animate objects. And it makes us resist it. It makes us fear it. And I took care of patients for 30 years. I've seen a lot of death. It's inevitable. Sometimes it comes way too soon. Sometimes it comes in the fullness of time. But it always comes. And being comfortable with our mortality, I think, is a critical element in our lifelong mental health. I think it helps us get our priorities right. So anyway, long backstory, but something provoked me. And usually when I write my columns on a given topic, there's been something in the scientific literature, there's been something in the media, there's been something in the New York Times that I read that elevates this in my own mind. And usually it's a theme that I've been ruminating on for a long time, sometimes much of my life. But then there's a provocation, and that provocation basically increases the concentration on that topic. I say, I've got to express this. Better out than in, to borrow from Shrek. And so, you know, rather than hold these feelings in, I'm going to express them on the page. And here we are.
That's fascinating. That's great. You mentioned how modern society values youthful ideals now more than ever before. How has the pace of change in our society affected the way older adults are perceived and valued?
Yeah, that's a really key point. And here, instead of thinking selfishly about me and my own aging, I think about my parents. My parents are quite vital at 85, my dad soon to be 86, and really doing remarkably well. And my dad and I routinely hike together. And so, you know, my dad's got Blue Zonian potential for sure. But they're old people now. There's no question they're old people. And obviously a change in pace of movement and the capacity to do physical things. And, you know, I notice a change in how they think and their ability to access their vocabulary. They're completely intact. But it's just, it's different at 85 than at 65. And the other issue with older age is that the world you knew gets left behind to one degree or another. And that's always affected successive generations, at least since the advent of agriculture. If you go back to human origins, there were long stretches in the Paleolithic era when not much changed generation to generation. And we have reason to understand from anthropologists and paleoanthropologists who do the best they can to figure out what life was like before anybody was recording history. We have reason to understand that old age was venerated because, yes, physical capabilities declined, but wisdom, born from experience, elevated. And there was essentially a tribal memory in older people who knew what life was like the prior generation, who could tell the tales of days before. And that's still venerated in some cultures around the world. Japan is famous for venerating older people. But my parents, when we get together, routinely talk about technology. And, you know, to put it sadly and bluntly, you know, on the information superhighway, they basically feel like roadkill. You know, I mean, they just, every time they catch up, there's some new thing. There's a new smartphone that, you know, is smart in ways that they no longer are.
True.
Our lives have shifted to the internet, social media, everything is technology based. And, you know, when my folks were born, there were no television sets. And, you know, so they remember the advent. In fact, they had ice boxes rather than freezers initially. And, you know, so we're talking about within the lifespan of people who are loved ones today, we went from ice boxes to freezers, and radio was entertainment, and then the earliest televisions. And, you know, here we are with little devices we can put in our pockets that allow us to instantaneously contact any individual anywhere on the world and talk to them as if they were standing right next to us. You know, none of this calling the international operator and hoping that a switchboard will connect you to somebody in Europe. I mean, I even remember that when I was in college, that was the way we got in touch with one another. Shocking changes, and technology begets technology. And so the more we develop these innovations, the more they accelerate new innovations. The result of which is the pace of change, as you mentioned in the question, is faster than it's ever been. And so those cycles that create what we might call human obsolescence are ever tighter. So, you know, for example, my children now range in age from 26 to 36. And they're already beginning to feel left behind. They look, you know, the tweens and teens who are sort of, you know, riding the waves of technological advance and kind of the masters of the universe. They're already doing stuff that my kids don't routinely do. And they're, you know, wondering.
Really interesting point.
Yeah. And of course, now we have AI. And my folks want no part of it. They're sort of, my mother's a creative writer, a poet, and, you know, just frets all the time about, you know, can AI write a poem? Don't you need to feel to write a poem? So even that clash between what makes humans human and to what extent is human intelligence a unique property of being human? We have those conversations all the time. They profoundly feel a sense of being left behind by the movement of society. And I, you know, again, that's certainly been going on to a minor extent since the dawn of agriculture, to a greater extent since the Industrial Revolution, to a far greater extent since the Digital Revolution, but at a far more accelerated pace today than ever before in history. And the only thing that will change the world around us faster than the trends of today are the trends of tomorrow, because we see no signs of this acceleration slowing. And yeah, I think that's a little bit scary for all of us. You know, instead of being venerated in old age for our wisdom and experience, we're just going to be looking around wondering what the hell is going on here.
That's a great point.
I can't do any of it.
Yep. Absolutely. Now, you've described, and we were just talking about it, the idea of anti-aging as misguided, and emphasize the importance of being the best version of ourselves in the present. How can we shift the conversation to embrace well-being at every stage of life?
Yeah, it's a challenge. And, you know, I don't know whether it's selfishness or empathy that causes me to take questions like this and direct them inward and say, so how am I doing? How am I wrestling with this? I, first of all, I feel it's very important to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. It's important to practice what we preach. But I also think, I've always thought this in my nutrition counseling or if I was guiding people about weight control, if I can't do it, I'm not sure I deserve to be talking about it, right? If my advice is good enough to work for somebody else, I certainly ought to be able to make it work for myself. I've always felt that way. So same thing here. So for instance, for many years when I worked out every day, I would have the goal of being better than the day before. You know, so whatever I was doing, the elliptical, the treadmill, running outside, you know, I'd want to run the same course a little faster. I'd want to burn a few more calories on the elliptical in the same amount of time. I'd want higher METs. If I was doing chin-ups or pull-ups, I'd want to be able to do one more than last week, that kind of thing. And for many years, that was possible. We are growing and essentially moving in the direction of our fullest potential throughout childhood and youth and adolescence and into early adulthood. But there comes a day when you're on the other side of the summit and starting to descend, and you'll never be better than you ever were before by some physical measure. But on the other hand, you know things you didn't know back then. You've experienced things you hadn't experienced yet. And wisdom and experience matter. They matter a lot. So one of the things I've been struggling to do, and I freely confess, you know, being very focused on physical vitality, I'm very outdoorsy. I hike, I ride horses, I ski. So those things are really, that kind of vitality has always mattered to me, along with intellectual vitality. What I'm trying to do is essentially hybridize the metric. If I look at the sum total of maintaining physical capability, so I'm still vital, and I hope and expect to be for quite some time. But I also think about my intellectual vigor, which is fundamentally intact, at least I hope so. But then I append to that experience and experiential knowledge and the wisdom of having lived through many crises and knowing that to some extent Kipling was right in his poem If, that triumph and disaster are both imposters to some extent, because inevitably following a triumph, there will be a disaster. But if we hang in there through a disaster, there will be another triumph.
And wise words.
It's cyclical. So that experiential wisdom accumulates over time and adds value to your personhood. And so if we think in terms of a meta metric, just sort of my intrinsic value to myself, and ideally to the people I love, what do I have to offer the people for whom I matter, generally the people who love you? And I think, well, it's different and it's changing, but it isn't less. It's less in some areas, maybe, you know, so maybe I'm a little less game, you know, to ski the double black diamond through the trees than I, you know, and jump off cliffs than I was 20 years ago. So wish my son a good time and see ya. You know, I'll meet you at the bottom, that kind of thing. But I can wrestle with challenges in whole new ways because of the accumulated life experience.
Well said.
So I think our society has cause to celebrate that, to recognize that, to revere that, to borrow from the traditions that came before and the few that still survive in the world today that venerate life experience. And that's not about anti-aging. That's actually about celebrating aging, because experience comes with the passage of time, as does aging. And if we think of aging as the process of accumulating experience and wisdom, it becomes something to celebrate. Yes, I want to stay vital. Yes, I'd like longevity. But I'm not going to resist aging. I don't want to be anti-aging. I want to embrace aging because it is imparting gifts to me. It exacts a toll, but it also imparts gifts. And that's a really important
perspective.
Thank you. That give and take, I think, reorients us. And so, you know, I try very hard, as my parents fuss about how technology has left them behind, to shift the conversation to the lore of the family and their life experience, where they have a treasure trove to share. And my wife and I and their grandchildren, my children, listen attentively to that. And we celebrate that.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about the other cultures who or that really embrace aging, and the word elder comes up a lot in those cultures. And, you know, that juxtaposed with the word elderly, and some of the other words that we use in our society really kind of undermine what it means to age and that wisdom, as you say, that people have collected.
Yeah. And, you know, again, ultimately, we're all destined to either die prematurely or become elderly. If there's a third choice, I haven't found. But you're right. The word elder typically means wise one, venerated one, whereas elderly typically, for our society at least, implies feeble. And you know, again, I was also talking about the themes in pop culture, the icons of beauty. And to some extent, that's okay. Because, I mean, for example, think about flowers. Think about a rose. The rose bud, with all the potential to open up into its full expression of beauty, is a thing of beauty, just like youth tends to be beautiful.
What a great analogy.
And then the rose in its full bloom is a thing of beauty. As it starts to wilt, maybe there's some beauty in the initial signs of the wilting, but ultimately we have to accept it's less beautiful than it once was. The fragrance diminishes, the physical beauty of the flower diminishes, and the same happens to us. But again, there's a trade-off. And so I don't mind that we celebrate the physical beauty of youthful vitality, as we do in movies and television and magazines and so forth. What we fail to do is to honor the trade-off. Imagine if our society, you know, had a whole slew of periodicals and magazines, and presumably they'd be internet-based as well as in physical print these days, that are all about the reflections, the storytelling, the wisdom, the life experience of older people, and we celebrated that the same way we do the beauty of young actors and actresses. And you know, there were a People magazine about older people, and it wasn't just pictures of some Hollywood star on a beach in a bikini and questioning, you know, whether or not she'd fully recovered since her pregnancy, that sort of thing. But, you know, it was the lives of icons from the last, who once had that, maybe, so famous people, fine. But what are they doing now? And what are they sharing with the world now? And how beautiful is that? It's a different kind of beauty, but there's potentially tremendous beauty there.
I love that.
So I don't think we do that nearly well enough. And I think we could. And I think the implications are really quite profound, because as mortal beings who celebrate youth and tend to rage at aging, as I said before, I do think that feeds into an anxiety, a fear of death and dying. If we celebrated how there's a give and take in the aging process, and how aging takes us to a place where we share with the world a different kind of beauty, we could embrace the process. And I think better accept the inevitable end product of the aging process, which is that we relinquish life. I am a poet myself. I've published a number of poems over the years. And in one of them, talk about the fact that life plays through us like the flight of birds and death is all around. I wear the weight of all its fingers pulling. But the idea that our lives, our living, belongs to us, but life does not. We borrow it. It's a force that blows through us like the wind or the flight of birds. We contain it for a while, and then we relinquish it back to wherever it is it came from. And there are obviously different points of view on that. I have my own, but even that, there's a beauty in that. That, you know, I had the opportunity to dance with the life force, but only for a while, and then the music stops and the dance ends, and it moves on. So I really think there's a fundamental reorientation possible in how we think about aging and how we think about dying.
Fascinating perspective. That's amazing. You know, now, as you referenced earlier in Our Rage at Aging, you talk about how we compare ourselves to our younger selves, or others can lead to despair. How can older adults reframe their mindset to avoid falling into that trap of comparing ourselves to our younger selves or others?
Yeah. So, you know, again, I've wrestled with this because the metrics of youthful productivity may be to some extent rooted in physical capability, to some extent endurance, and even cognitive endurance, the number of hours you could work. I sort of prided myself in the early going being a workaholic, because when you're ambitious and you want to make a difference in the world, I even give this advice when young people seek out my counsel. I say, in the early going of your career, you kind of have to say yes to everything, unless it's really diametrically opposed to where you want to go. If it's even vaguely in the direction you want to go, say yes to everything. That's how you build your portfolio. And the more you do, the more you create opportunities to do the very specific things you want to do. Later in your career, you have to get good at saying no. It's very different. But if you then compare yourself in the stage of life where you've learned to say no and need to say no, and your priorities have shifted, you don't want to work 18-hour days anymore, enough is enough. You know, having done that for 40 years, you're tired. You're just, you know, burned out a little bit. But if you compare your productivity now to your productivity then, it's less. And your tolerance and your endurance for hard work now, it's less. And your physical capability is less. But again, you maybe have a greater equanimity. You have a broader perspective. Your priorities have shifted. I went for decades with zero recreation in my life. I particularly recall one three-year span at one point in my career where I happened to have, in addition to my daily obligations of seeing patients and teaching and administrative obligations, I was under three simultaneous book deadlines. And I took one day off in 3 years, literally one day. There was one day I didn't work at all. I think it was Thanksgiving Day, 1 year out of the three. And other than that, I was working generally at least 70-hour weeks every week, straight through the weekend. Evenings and weekends were my time to write the books because I had a day job. And when it was finally done and I turned in the last of the three books, I felt like I'd gotten out of jail and celebrated that day with my wife and said, never again. This was crazy. You know, so I'm in building mode. I'm trying to build who I am in the world, which, you know, obviously the more substantial and perhaps more elevated the foundation we build, the greater the heights we can hope to reach, the more we can hope to contribute. All that mattered to me. And it matters still, but I also now have the perspective on the cost of the time away from my kids. I was very honest with them when I was about to disappear into major obligations, whether it was a book or taking care of a seriously ill patient in the ICU that was going to take up my whole summer, I'd sit down with my kids and I'd explain, I don't want to be apart from you. Mm-hmm. And obviously, mom will be there those hours I'm not, and I wish we could play more. And my hope is someday you'll be proud of me for the trade-off. This is hard on me too, but still, it's not the same.
That's great, though, that you were so honest with them and open with them at the time.
Yeah.
A lot of times that doesn't happen.
I hope I'd have to ask them now, because, sure. Now obviously they could reflect back at me about all this. Did that resonate? Did it matter? Did it make it feel different for them? But I have to say, I kind of envy my wife's intimacy with our children. Because she was always there. And by the way, she's a scientist. She's a neuroscientist. She got her PhD at Princeton. She's brilliant. But she made a choice. Once we have five kids, once we got to kid number four, she said, you go out there, you do your thing. I'm staying here to do mine. I'm going to raise these people. And so we did that division of labor because that's what she wanted to do. But she was just there through everything. And so now, I love my children. They love me. We're close, but on a daily basis, when there's just some little thing to talk about, my wife is always in on it. And with dad, it's kind of on a need to know basis, and dad doesn't really need to know much. And okay, fine. But I see that now as part of the cost of the decisions I made. So it's a broader perspective. So I don't want to compare myself to who I was then. I want to think about who am I now? And yes, I'm leaving some things behind. But I'm acquiring some things too, some sacrifice, but lots of acquisition. So how do I take the portfolio of assets available to me now, my physical capabilities, my mental capabilities, my emotional intelligence, and my life experience? How do I take all of that and create the best set of priorities, create the best set of behaviors? How do I be the person my dogs think I am?
I love that.
How do I, that's the best version of me. So I don't have to be able to do more chin-ups today than I ever could do before in my life to be the best version of me. So even, the comparison, the mirror we look into, as we strive to see the best version of ourselves and be the best version of ourselves, shouldn't be, what did I look like 30 years ago? I mean, who cares? It's not relevant. I can look at those pictures and celebrate that stage of my life, but I don't want to compete with that stage of my life. I want to be different now the difference.
So looking forward, what are you looking forward to as you age?
Honestly, it's a challenging time to grapple with that because I've been looking forward to peace, lesser expectations. You kind of like the idea that, look, I felt, because I could make a positive difference in the world, that I had to. I don't recall when my parents first exposed me to Edmund Burke, but I have the distinct impression of growing up with the words of Burke echoing in my head, for evil to prevail in the world, it is enough for good people to do nothing. So you can never do nothing. You always have to do your utmost to propagate good in the world. I felt that as an obligation. I was privileged. My parents loved me and took good care of me and my sister and gave us opportunity. And they never asked me to pay it back any more than I've asked my kids to pay it back. So I felt obligated to pay it forward. And so I wanted to rage not against the dying of the light, not against aging. I wanted to rage when I was young and had the capacity to rage. And I don't mean literal rage. I mean doing my utmost to enhance the human condition, to propagate goodness, to, as a physician, to save lives, protect lives, defend years in life, life in years. And I readily admit that my view of being a health professional in 2025 absolutely ineluctably includes the health of the planet. We have some hope of being healthy, vital people on a healthy, vital planet, or we have little to no hope of being healthy, vital people. So I am an ardent proponent of protecting planetary health. So I was looking forward to that stage in life where I could without feeling guilty, without feeling pulled in other directions, just deeply enjoy the incredible bond I'm privileged to have with my wife. I love my wife, and my wife loves me, and it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, like any marriage over all these decades, we've had really rough patches, but we've always come out stronger on the other side of those. So the level of understanding now is just, it's such a beautiful thing. I just want to be able to enjoy that. I love the outdoors, and I love my relationships with other species, dogs and horses in particular. And so I had been looking forward to unencumbered time with my dogs and my horses and the outdoors. The reason I say was looking forward to it, was looking forward to peace, was looking forward to this, is things don't always work out quite as you hope. I've had a very varied career, 30 years in academic medicine, but I have an inventive mind. I hold a number of patents. And I wound up inventing something really quite important in medicine. And the only way to get it to daylight was to found a company. So at this stage of my life, this now takes me back the better part of a decade, but I wound up doing something altogether new in which I had zero experience. I became an entrepreneur, founded a company, and then ran that company. It's called Diet ID. And we were acquired by a food as medicine company called Tangelo. But a whole new set of stresses and obligations, and of course, hiring people, which means their livelihoods are dependent on me and my decisions. And so a whole new set of pressures.
Are you still involved with the company?
Yes. Yeah. So again, we were acquired by Tangelo, and I'm chief medical officer now for the combined company, and still very actively involved in advancing the mission of Diet ID, which is to make diet quality a vital sign like blood pressure. Just a quick digression here. It's not today's topic, but diet quality measured objectively is the single leading predictor in the United States today for premature death from all causes. In other words, if you could fix just one thing to decrease the likelihood that you're going to die prematurely from anything that routinely kills people, it would be your diet quality. It's that important. Single leading predictor variable for chronic diseases. So, wow. I mean, that sounds really important. Sounds like information everybody should have, right? But almost nobody does, because historically it's been far too hard to get. 90-minute food frequency questionnaire, record everything you eat for a week, just painful stuff. So basically what we've been needing is the analog to a blood pressure cuff. You know, if it were, blood pressure is critical information too. It's predictive of your risk of heart attack and stroke and death. And so we measure it in absolutely everybody. So every patient tends to know their blood pressure. Every health professional knows their blood pressure. We know what it is and we know what it ought to be. And we compare the two. And if they're not the same, we do something about it. Well, as the single leading predictor of premature death, diet quality deserves to be treated that way. But it required an advance in assessment capability. We built that. We patented that. We published that. And we can do a comprehensive dietary assessment in as little as 60 seconds. So my mission now in life is to make diet quality a vital sign.
That's great.
So I'm looking forward to progress in that area. It would be very nice to leave that behind as a legacy. As I think about defying Dylan Thomas, because I very much want to go gentle into that good night. I don't think we want to rage against the dying of the light any more than we want to rage against aging. I think we want to get our raging over with when we're young and full of energy so that we can embrace the quietude in the later ages. So I'm looking forward to feeling fulfilled. I'm looking forward to feeling like I lived up to my potential, made the contributions I felt obligated to make, and can now just celebrate the love I'm privileged to have in my life. All of that, all of those aspirations, which I think are still valid, have been troubled by trends in the world around us. The threats to things I took for granted, like democracy, the threats to the health of the planet. You know, I never thought as a child I'd need to worry about there not being an Amazon rainforest, but maybe I do. I never thought I had to worry about there not being glaciers in Antarctica, but maybe I do. I never thought I'd be living in a world where maybe polar bears would go extinct for want of snow and ice to hunt on, but maybe I do. I feel all these things, and I feel them more intimately than anything that's vague and far away, like the Amazon or Antarctica. I feel them in the woods next to my house, where I see a lot of sickly trees that, you know, 30 years ago were all healthy. And they no longer are, because everything about the climate is changing. And so as I watch the beech trees die, I struggle to find the balance between, this is a stage in my life where I can hike far more often than I used to and be in these woods. But I feel the pain of the plight and the blight in these woods. And so it's not a simple question anymore. You know, I would have loved it had it been. Maybe it never is. Maybe every generation aspires to things, sees the golden years coming, and then something comes along to tarnish them. Life is complicated. But those are still more time with the people I love, more unencumbered time, less feeling torn, always torn. I'm accustomed to feeling torn. Whatever it is I'm doing, I'm worried about the other things that need to be done.
Interesting.
And one last thing to throw in the mix here, and I guess I'm sort of with my folks on this one. I think the internet, as powerful as it has been, you know, to advance our access to information, and it, you know, it's an incredible tool in many ways. I do think it has, in some ways, attenuated quality of life. I can barely remember what it was like to have a pre-internet weekend where you'd go home at the end of a work weekend. That was it. Nobody, you know, you. Unless a newspaper was delivered to your door, or you sought out new, you were just with your tribe. That was it.
That's right.
You were alone, and of course, even during the work week, the pace of responses was different. You know, so you couldn't email a document and say edit this immediately and send it back to me. You'd have to mail it to people, and then you know we had the advent of fax machines. You could fax it, and then it'd have to be, you know, edited and sent back. But you know, everything took days, if not weeks, and that was the pace of life. The expectations are now bundled into hours and minutes, if not seconds. You know, I emailed you 10 seconds ago. I texted you, where the heck are you?
What's wrong with you?
So all of that is an intrusion into life. And I think the only way to escape that is not to have professional obligations that keep you online, so you could actually say, I'm off the grid. I don't have to be here. I'm off the grid. I'm not there yet. So I aspire to the day when, because of security and having taken good care of my family, and because I have solidified the key contributions I want to make that will allow me to go gentle into that good night feeling fulfilled.
It's beautiful.
That I can turn all this off and say, I'm not going back on the internet, you know, whatever it is, Friday to Monday, or maybe, you know, in retirement weekends, don't matter. But whatever period I want, I can go off the grid whenever I want to. I aspire to that. I look forward to that. I kind of feel like I've got a ways to go to get there from here.
I love that thought. And I do think that's getting more and more difficult, you know, as we go. I mean, I definitely remember the days when I didn't have access to email, my work emails at home, and you know, and just the pace of everything. And I mean, in some ways it's exciting, and in other ways it's
shackles. We're chained to it. It's a ball and chain, and you can't take it off and you can't get away. And smartphones make it worse, because, you know, even if you don't want to be online, but you want to hear from your kids if they happen to need something urgent. Three of my daughters live in LA, and so we've been dealing with the fires at the time we're having this conversation.
Everybody okay?
Everybody's okay, but they all had to leave their homes, and then they may need to do it again. And they live in several different areas of LA. So, yeah everybody's fine. Everybody's safe, but crazy and scarier probably from far away than for them. They have a feel for what's going on and how proximal the danger. I'm reading about it from 3,000 miles away, and it's completely freaking me out. But obviously, we want to know, my wife and I, if anything changes. So you never leave your smartphone behind. And then, you know, whether you want it or not, you get news alerts about the latest thing happening in Washington, D.C., or school shootings, or in the next, you know, you're just sucked back in. So the change in the texture of life, the change in the periodicity of life, and the change in our freedoms from what's happening everywhere in the world all the time, irrevocably altered by the internet and everything it has spawned.
Sure. You know, and I think with that, you know, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but youth is really glorified. You know, you mentioned People magazine and you know, all of the other mass media out there that's reinforcing that perception, you know, in advertising, movies, social media, that sort of thing. How do you think marketers can help reshape the public perceptions of aging?
Well, I suppose to some extent, since marketers are in the service of selling things, we have to think about what's being sold. And obviously, there are different commodities that might be celebrated among elders than among youth. I imagine that hair products and skin products and perfume and cologne, you know, to whatever extent they still matter, might be a little less central. And we might be more in the realm of shared ideas and perspectives and experiences. And so, you know, I think, just as I was saying, you know, we could have a parallel to People Magazine, older People Magazine, mm-hmm. and it, you know, the marketers would maybe be focusing on books or appropriate health-related products or spas that cater to older people, vacation spots. Obviously, older people have more time to travel typically, generally have more resources. I think there's a whole slew of things that can be marketed. Unfortunately, what we mostly see is the marketing of pharmaceuticals. So at another intrusion in our lives, we get ever more direct-to-consumer marketing of pharmaceutical products, and some of that targets the older population. I think we could do much better than that, because what we tend to get, you know, sort of beauty products for the young and drugs to help fix what's broken for the elderly. But that actually does require something else. The simple reality is we're not a very healthy nation, and we have systematically neglected the fundamentals of health. So diet quality in the U.S. is poor. As noted, it's the single leading predictor for premature death from all causes. We're not nearly as physically active as we should. We have too much exposure to toxic substances, tobacco still, excess alcohol. We don't get enough sleep. We're a nation of insomniacs. We're stressed out, and we're not very good at mitigating stress. And the internet and social media have interfered with our social connections with other people. So we spend more time alone. And of course, the pandemic contributed that as well, moving many people out of the physical workspace to a virtual workspace, but increasing isolation. Our Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, talked about the epidemic of loneliness, and he's quite right. So we have all of these factors we neglect, and as a result, we're not very healthy. And so in reality, older people in an unhealthy culture accumulate health problems and need all these drugs, but it needn't be that way. We can look to the blue zones and see it's perfectly possible for humans to live to 80, 90, 100 and not have any chronic disease and not succumb to dementia. You don't get a guarantee no matter what you do. I routinely point out to people, because of course, over the course of my clinical career, there were times I had patients who did everything right, even colleagues, who succumbed to some terrible disease. And I've always thought of it, and I've always talked about it like this: we can control ship and sail. And so we can be masterful captains of the ship of our medical destiny. We'll never control wind and wave. There can be a gale that comes up at sea that can cause the most ably sailed seaworthy vessel to founder. Nobody gets a guarantee, but the probability of a safe crossing obviously goes up monumentally if your ship is sound and your crew is capable.
I love that.
And your captain is skillful. So if you think about, you know, the components of your body in those terms, yeah, take good care of it. Makes an enormous difference. So no guarantee, but the probability of living long and prospering with vitality goes up enormously if you get the lifestyle proposition right. We should be doing that in this country. We certainly should have done it during the pandemic. Another quick digression: it's been estimated in the scientific literature that 60% or more of the toll of COVID in this country, hospitalizations and death, were attributable to the prior pandemic of cardiometabolic disease that hides in plain sight. In other words, because we went into the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic already sick, that virus made us so much sicker than we needed to get. So a lot of people got hospitalized, a lot of people died because they were already sick before they got the infection, and so the infection was terribly severe. Had we been a healthier nation coming in, a 60% lesser toll without masks and vaccines, to say nothing of what we could have done to reduce the total toll if we had combined general health promotion with specific protection against that virus. So we've got all these issues that invite the marketing of pharmaceuticals to older people. So it's not just we should change the marketing, we should change the paradigm, we should change the dialogue, we should be talking about the wisdom of older people, the life experience, the emotional intelligence, all that. We should. We absolutely should. But I think we also, if we hope to de-emphasize the role of big pharma in what does get marketed to elders, we need healthier elders. And in order to have healthier elders, we need a healthier us, all of us, because health begins early in life. And the earlier you intervene to start protecting it, the better. It's never too late, but the earlier, the better. We talk about the fact, I'm a preventive medicine specialist, board certified in preventive medicine. We talk about the fact that the best way to prevent osteoporosis in older women is to do the right thing in young women, is to make sure that peak bone density is achieved in the 20s. And because inevitably you're going to start losing bone. Again, aging is going to happen. But if you're losing bone from a higher peak, you can withstand that bone loss before crossing the threshold to fracture and disability and die with an intact skeleton. If you never build adequate bone density in the first place, and a lot of young women don't, you start that decline from a much lower peak and you cross the threshold to fracture and disability. And unfortunately, that's a very prevalent issue. So all these different considerations for beginning the protection of health and vitality early in life. And so we're going to think about anti-aging. We should be thinking about promoting health for young people and protecting it across the lifespan. That's the only kind of anti-aging I can sign up for. Yes, it actually does forestall the ravages of aging. So we have the opportunity to live long, prosper with vitality, and then go gentle into that good night, and ideally pretty quickly. You know, I return often to the lessons of the Blue Zones. People live long. They don't get chronic disease. They don't tend to get dementia. And more often than not, they die in their sleep. A peaceful exit in the fullness of time. And folks, those three things, that's the trifecta right there, right? Vitality, longevity, a peaceful exit. It doesn't get better for mortals. And we are mortals.
Indeed, indeed. Now, you teamed with Mark Bittman to write a book called How to Eat All Your Food and Diet Questions Answered. What advice do you have for older adults who are overwhelmed by conflicting health and nutrition information?
Well, as per the case we make in that book, it's unbelievably simple. Michael Pollan, a science and formerly nutrition writer, he's actually now turned his keen intelligence to other topics. But he's famous for having said, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And it's amazing how much consensus there is among world-leading nutrition experts that that's fundamentally right. In other words, eat real food. So you ought to be able to identify most of your food as food, something that comes from a place in nature. If it's got a long, complicated ingredient list that runs off the package, if it looks like it would probably glow in the dark if you turned out the lights, frankenfood, that's not real food. If you can't tell what part of the natural world it comes from, is it animal, vegetable, mineral, or combinations of those? If you just can't tell, that's not food. It's a food thing. It's a frankenfood, but it's not food. So eat real food. Not too much, actually, you don't have to worry about if you get food quality right. One of the beautiful things about wholesome foods and sensible assemblies is they fill us up on many fewer calories than ultra-processed food. Ultra-processed food is actually designed, engineered to maximize the calories it takes to feel full. Wholesome food direct from nature fills us up on many fewer calories. So the not too much that Michael Pollan emphasized actually takes care of itself. And then mostly plants. So all of the evidence, and I've written four editions of a leading nutrition textbook for physicians, so I am mired in the evidence. I've spent my whole career in the evidence. I took care of patients for 30 years. I ran a research lab at Yale for 25. written textbooks on the topic. All the evidence indicates that if you mostly eat vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds, and drink plain water when thirsty, you just can't go too far wrong. Can you do that and still have dairy because you want to? Sure. Can you do that and have eggs because you want to? Sure. Fish and seafood? Sure. Meat and poultry? Sure. But your diet needs to mostly be vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds, and plain water when thirsty. If you mostly do that, you simply can't go too far wrong. And you can ignore all the cockamamie theories and all the fad diets in the places around the world where people derive the greatest health benefit and the greatest pleasure from food. They are not watching the morning shows to find out what they ought to be eating this week. They're eating the way they've eaten for a lifetime. They're eating the way the prior generation ate and the generation before that and the generation before that. Think of everything you've heard about the Mediterranean diet. It's not a diet that somebody cooked up in a fad diet book. It's a celebration of culinary diversity in a part of the world we would all happily go to enjoy delicious food. It just happened to be healthy. You know, it's good luck. I mean, they didn't choose olive oil knowing the benefits of oleic acid back in ancient Greece. Just happened to be a climate where olives grew and they contain a lot of oil. But it turns out it's, you know, extra virgin olive oil is really good for you. And everything else about the Mediterranean diet is good for you, but it's also delicious. You can love food that loves you back. So Mark and I, just a quick word about the book. So, you know, I suspect everybody listening knows Mark Bittman, wrote his column in the New York Times for many years, and has a really encyclopedic knowledge of food systems. But isn't a physician and doesn't know the details of nutrition and chronic disease the way I do. So it was a beautiful partnership. We struck up a correspondence some years ago after a column he wrote. He wrote back to me. We started a dialogue. We became friends. We started to collaborate. We did a couple of pieces together in New York Magazine. They kind of went viral. And they were on this topic, the last conversation you'll ever need to have about food and nutrition, all your questions answered. And after we did two columns that sort of went viral, obviously publishers approached us and said, guys, you got more in the tank. Could you do a book? And the way we did How to Eat was a conversation. We sequestered ourselves on where Mark lives on a farm in upstate New York. And we just tossed questions back and forth. And, you know, whoever was asking the question, the other one of us would answer. And we recorded it all and then transcribed it and then edited it. And it became the book. And we wanted to make sure we covered every question we could think of on behalf of everybody else who could ask a question.
Interesting approach.
And it's a conversation. So when you read How to Eat, it feels like you're pulling a chair up to the coffee table in the morning, and I'm there, and Mark's there, and you're there, and we're just chatting. But we really did try to cover everything. And we joke in that book, as I have in other somewhat more scholarly books I've written, you know, if you're writing a book about dietary sense and the truth about food and how to eat, it only need be 7 words long, because Michael Pollan nailed it. Eat food, not too much, most of the plants. That's never going to change. Now, you want all the details, you know, which plants and what are the benefits from this? And what about sourcing protein? And is it okay to be vegan and vegan versus vegetarian? And is it okay to eat fish? And what about toxins? And that's where we die. That's where we can devote the whole book to it. But no need to be confused. Fundamentally, if you mostly eat vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds, and mostly drink plain water when thirsty, you're going to have a healthy diet, and you're going to derive a benefit from that. And you can situate that in whatever context you like, meaning whatever cultural diet feels right for you. If you're Mexican American or Chinese American or Vietnamese, there are cultural lanes you can put that same dietary pattern in, get all the nutrition right, but do it in a way where the food is actually and the dishes are appealing to you. Because again, I think what we're all striving for, we want to love food that loves us back. We want to get pleasure from good food and pleasure from good health. And you don't need to choose one over the other.
Sure, sure. Yeah, interesting. Now, you know, many seniors are facing barriers such as limited mobility, loss of appetite, or living alone, the isolation that we talked about earlier. What strategies can help older adults overcome these challenges to maintain a nutritious diet?
Well, you know, once you are frail and have limited mobility, I think society needs to help. We need programming. And among the innovations in that area would be everything that's happening in the food as medicine space. And that's where I work today. So Tangelo, and you could learn more at jointangelo.com. We're a food as medicine company. We deliver high quality, medically tailored, culturally specific food to people's doors. And usually insurance companies are paying for that. So there are all sorts of arrangements that could be put together involving clinicians who are assessing your health, insurers who are responsible for covering your healthcare needs and are interested in making as much money as possible and spending as little as possible. And we have all kinds of evidence that spending more money on healthy food involves spending less on drugs and hospital admissions. And so it's a win-win proposition. And then societal reforms that make such programming available to more and more people. So once people are older and frail and mobility is limited, I think we need innovations like that. If we're talking about people who are not immobile and can get out of the house, ideally we would be looking more at supporting mixed-use neighborhoods, and we see a lot of this. So we didn't talk about the built environment, but the environments around us have significant implications for how we get physical activity, how we access food. And there's a very strong argument for neighborhoods the way they used to be, where, you know, it wasn't just everybody lives over here and all the shopping is miles away and you have to drive to it, but mixed-use neighborhoods, as they prevail in much of Europe still, where you do your shopping because, you know, you walk to the market. And the food is more accessible because you can walk there, but you're also getting physical activity because you can walk there and that kind of thing. So I think we ought to be thinking about societal level solutions. And then, of course, individuals can take matters into their own hands simply by knowing what's important. And again, what we do at Diet ID as part of Tangelo now is we offer people the ability to assess their diet. And we assess it down to the level of nutrient intake. So where do I have nutrient deficiencies? Where should I make specific changes in my diet to improve its overall balance? People should have access to that kind of information. So I think we should empower individuals with actionable intel about their diet, where they are, where it ought to be, and how to get there from here. And then I think we need supporting services involving clinicians. My clinical tribe, Lifestyle Medicine, is all over this issue. I think we need innovations in reimbursement. I think we need innovations in wellness programming. I think employers can get involved. And I think this should be a multi-generational proposition, because although people tend to diet alone, we live it together. And I think a lifetime of eating well and celebrating the value proposition of optimal diet for both health and pleasure then spills over into older years. You carry those good habits with you. It's less of an issue. If you weren't eating well before and are suddenly struggling to get it right, everything's going to be unfamiliar. It's more of a challenge. So again, as with preventing osteoporosis, you want to focus on young women so the fractures never happen to old women. If we want older people to eat well, we need to think about how do we shift our whole society away from eating a diet of mostly ultra-processed junk to eating better so it's a lifelong habit that everybody acquires.
That's really smart. Now, cognitive decline is a major concern for many older adults. Based on your research, what foods or dietary patterns are most protective for brain health as we age?
So the only thing I'd say, I'd probably give a shorter answer than you might expect here. The brain is a vital organ that is part of the body. So is the left kidney. So is the right kidney. So is the spleen, the liver, and the pancreas. And we could go around the horn. You really can't eat to feed any one of them in isolation of any of the others. By the way, so is the microbiome. So a healthy you is the best way to have a healthy brain, because your brain is serviced by the detoxification organs, the kidneys, the liver. You will not have a healthy brain if you don't have healthy kidneys and liver. It is obviously serviced by the cardiovascular system, which pumps oxygenated blood and nutrients to it. You cannot have an optimally healthy brain without clean blood vessels and healthy blood flow. So the question really reverts mostly to how do you achieve optimal health? Now, yeah, you can point to properties of specific foods that might be particularly good for the brain. Omega-3 fat, for example. So long-chain omega-3 fats. And for those who like the esoterica, we're talking about EPA or eicosapentaenoic acid and DHA, docosahexaenoic acid, found in fatty fish and some algae, by the way. That's where the fish get it. These things are incorporated into the brain, DHA in particular, and are very important to the healthy functioning of brain neurons, the cells that make up the brain. And most American diets are relatively deficient in these. So you could argue that a supplement or eating fatty fish routinely would be a good thing. I, by the way, take an algae supplement every day for just that reason.
Interesting.
I eat fish very occasionally. I'm vegan most of the time. And I gave up eating fish and seafood for the most part, not because I don't think it's good for me, but because I don't think it's good for the fish. In other words, we're depleting the oceans of fisheries. We're doing damage to the planet. We just, you know, 8 billion hungry Homo sapiens just can't keep eating up all the life on the planet without devastating consequences. So I eat overwhelmingly plants, but you can't readily access the long chain omega-3s in plants. So I supplement with an algae-based omega-3 supplement that gives me the EPA and DHA I could otherwise get from eating wild salmon. And that way I can leave the wild salmon to the brown bears and the other critters who need them. And then, you know, I think people famously have heard about something called anthocyanidins in blueberries. These are particular antioxidants. But blueberries are good for your heart and good for your vasculature and, yeah, good for your brain because antioxidants protect cells against damage from oxidative compounds. So it's not really specific brain protection. And omega-3 is good at reducing inflammation in the body. So it's not just good for your brain, it's good for your joints and your immune system balance and so forth. So ultimately, I would say the formula is the same. I really wouldn't change a thing. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Eat a wide variety of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds, and mostly drink water when thirsty. That's the best formula for your brain. It's the best formula for your left kidney. It's the best formula for your adrenal glands and pick any other vital organ. It's the best formula for your microbiome, which is best thought of as a vital organ. I've received the question over recent years, do I need to eat to feed my microbiome? And I've reverted with, did you ever have the impression you needed to eat to feed your right kidney, right? I mean, you know, you want to take care of yourself. A healthy you supports healthy parts of you. Healthy parts of you support a healthy whole you. It's all one package deal. Just, you know, the things that are best for you are the things that are best for all of you. So that's how I take care of my brain. You can get more detailed information about specifics of brain health, including not just diet, but mental exercises and physical exercises and the importance of sleep from a number of experts who focus on that. My favorites, two very dear friends of mine, are the doctors Shirzai, Aisha, A-Y-E-S-H-A, and Dean Shirzai, S-H-E-R-Z-A-I. So they call themselves the brain docs. And they're both neurological specialists who've devoted their careers to helping people achieve greatest possible brain health. So if you want to learn more on that topic, I commend you to the work of the Shirzais.
That's interesting. And you know, and you mentioned blueberries, and the first thing I thought of was, you know, I remember hearing a lot of discussion of superfoods over the years. Is that, what's your opinion of that? Is superfoods a real thing? Is it a way to kind of package it up and let consumers know these are the ones that you should focus on?
I don't think it's a real thing, because if you have superfoods incorporated in a bad diet, the net effect on your health will be mediated by the bad diet. And if you have a good diet, but no emphasis on superfoods, a super diet will prevail over the lack of any particular superfood. So, you know, worth calling out that some foods are really rich in a wide variety of nutrients our bodies need. And in particular, if they're rich in nutrients that are hard to get someplace else. So, you know, again, talking about omega-3 fat, which tends to be deficient in our diet, you could point to walnuts as a source of plant omega-3s or flax seeds or fatty fish like wild salmon. Or you could source it directly from algae, but it's an important nutrient. We could talk about highly concentrated sources of fiber and calcium and magnesium and potassium. So there are particularly good sources of nutrients we really need and don't tend to get enough of. And that's a super thing.
Sure. That's a great takeaway.
But you're not going to compensate for a poor diet by choosing occasionally the food that's currently under the halo of superfood, you know, the one that's appearing on TV shows and so forth. So I've largely rejected that whole concept of superfoods. I think it's a distraction with regard to diet and maybe with regard to everything else too. We tend to look for quick fixes, silver bullets, and scapegoats, when in fact the big picture is really what matters. So I would say when it comes to diet, make sure you're somebody who can see the forest through the trees. because for the most part, the trees are about somebody trying to sell you something.
Well said. Really interesting point. Now, Dr. Katz, you've been incredibly generous with your time today, and I could go on and on several other questions that I had, but I do want to be respectful of your time as well. We end each episode of Roundtable Talk with this question: what have you learned that you wished you could have told your younger self?
I've been asked this before. I've been asked it by young people who, so, you know, because of what I've done in academic medicine, I get requests from medical students and residents, people early in their career, seek career advice. And they ask me, what do you wish you knew when you were at my stage of life that you know now? And my answer is usually this: not a thing. Because frankly, if you knew how hard it all is and you knew how many blind alleys you would have to go down into and turn around and come out and accomplish nothing before you found the main path of your life, I think it would inhibit you from being as energetic and creative. I liked the naivete of youth because it fueled the drive of youth. Everything felt possible to me then because I hadn't failed nearly as many times as I have now. So I kind of celebrate what I didn't know back then. And now that I know it, it's okay because I'm at a different phase of life. Again, what we talked about all along, that life experience, that wisdom, that's valuable. But I don't think I wanted it then because it would have been baggage. It would have made me think as I tried something new and bold, this is more likely to fail than succeed because most of the stuff we try to do in life fails, right?
That's,
I mean,
right.
You have to, you know, to put it in other terms, you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you find the prince or princess you're looking for. And if you knew that in advance, that I'm going to spend years of my life kissing frogs, you know, you might give up hope. And hope is vital fuel. And in fact, when you do persist and persevere, because you're not aware that you're much more likely to fail than succeed, you do succeed. And then those successes, they become the important thing, not all the failures. But I was quite content not knowing what I didn't know, and I don't think I would change that.
I love that. That's not something that we have heard before, but that really is an important perspective. Dr. Katz, I can't thank you enough for all the time you gave us today. Really, really appreciate you sharing your insights.
Thank you, Derek. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And I'd like to also thank Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time on Roundtable Talk. You have a great rest of the day, Dr. Katz.
You too.